This is the weekly podcast from the Journal of Neurosurgery. Hello and welcome. I'm Natalie Pincham, and I'll be reading synopses of some of the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery on August 23rd, 2013. The topics of the articles in this podcast are traumatic brain injury, vascular disorders, pituitary surgery, oncology, stereotactic radiosurgery, and functional neurosurgery. Role of subconcussion in repetitive mild traumatic brain injury. A review article by Julian Bales and colleagues. There has been an explosion in the scientific and medical knowledge concerning sports-related concussion during the last decade. In addition to the obvious deleterious effects that concussions may have, research now suggests that head impacts can occur during contact sports in which a concussion is not diagnosed, suspected, or recognized. Biophysics studies have shown that athletes at the collegiate and high school levels sustain a surprisingly high number of head impacts, ranging from several hundred to well over 1,000 annually. The associated cumulative impact burdens over the course of a career are equally impressive and important. Clinical studies have identified athletes with no observable symptoms, but with functional impairment as measured by neuropsychological testing and functional MRI. In addition, autopsy material has shown that there are subsets of athletes in contact sports who do not have a history of known or identified concussions, but have nonetheless demonstrated neurodegenerative pathology consistent with chronic traumatic encephalopathy. Laboratory research using models that do not cause alteration of behavior has demonstrated axonal injury, blood-brain barrier permeability, and evidence of neuroinflammation. Subconcussion is an emerging concept that requires consideration of its potential role and impact in those exposed to repetitive cranial impacts. Risk of very early recurrent cerebrovascular events in symptomatic carotid artery stenosis. A clinical article by Marie-Louise Monod and co-authors. In a study of 94 patients with symptomatic carotid artery stenosis, the authors determined the risk of recurrent cerebrovascular events before carotid artery interventions. The patients had a non-disabling stroke, a transient ischemic attack, or an amaurosis fugax. As the recurrence risk has been reported to be highest within the first days of the onset of symptoms, the authors focused on very early recurrences, that is, those occurring within 3 days of admission to the hospital. Furthermore, the authors looked at the risk of early carotid artery intervention within 48 hours of admission. Overall, 15 recurrent cerebrovascular events were noted in the period between admission to carotid artery intervention. These events included 3 strokes, 5 transient ischemic attacks, and 1 amaurosis fugax within the first 72 hours. After that time, only recurrent transient ischemic attacks occurred. When examining the incidence of complications of carotid artery intervention, the authors identified 3 procedure-related strokes and 1 transient ischemic attack. The frequency of these events was similar between procedures performed within the first 48 hours and those performed later. In summary, the recurrence rate of cerebrovascular events was quite low, but all recurrent strokes occurred within 3 days. This raises the question whether carotid artery intervention in cases of symptomatic carotid artery stenosis should be performed on an emergency basis in clinically stable patients. Further studies are needed to answer this question. Effect of antiplatelet therapy on thromboembolism after flow diversion with the pipeline embolization device. A clinical article by Robert Heller and colleagues. Flow diverting stents, such as the pipeline embolization device, offer a novel treatment approach to intracranial aneurysms. However, data regarding the incidence of acute procedure-related thromboembolic complications following their use remains scant. The authors sought to determine the rate of embolic events in a bid to identify potential risk factors and assess the role of platelet inhibition in the occurrence of these events. Procedural embolic events were detected using magnetic resonance diffusion-weighted imaging obtained within 24 hours of the procedure. The degree of platelet inhibition in response to aspirin and clopidogrel was evaluated using formal light transmission platelet aggregometry, the historic gold standard for platelet function analysis. Ischemic events were identified following 52% of the 25 procedures. By univariate analysis, the authors found no significant difference between cases with and without procedural embolism in platelet inhibition by aspirin or clopidogrel. By multivariate analysis, they found larger aneurysm size, especially greater than 1 centimeter, to be the single variable significantly associated with procedural embolism. The authors concluded that acute embolism following use of the pipeline embolization device for treatment of intracranial aneurysms is more common than hypothesized. Strength of antiplatelet therapy, as measured by residual platelet aggregation, did not appear to be associated with cases of procedural embolism. Factors predicting postoperative hyponatremia and efficacy of hyponatremia management strategies after more than 1,000 pituitary operations. A clinical article by Arman Jahangiri and co-authors. Hyponatremia, typically caused by syndrome of inappropriate antidiuretic secretion, is a common morbidity after pituitary surgery that can be profoundly symptomatic and cause costly readmissions. The authors calculated the frequency of postoperative hyponatremia after more than 1,000 consecutive pituitary surgeries performed over a 5-year period. They determined the efficacy of interventions correcting hyponatremia. They found that postoperative hyponatremia occurred after 16% of pituitary surgeries, with an early and delayed peak occurring at postoperative day 2 and between postoperative day 7 and 9, respectively. Nearly 20% of hyponatremic patients were symptomatic, and nearly 15% were readmitted for an average of 5 days. A multivariate analysis including lesion size, age, sex, number of prior pituitary surgeries, surgical approach, pathology, lesion location, and preoperative hypopituitarism revealed that only preoperative hypopituitarism predicted postoperative hyponatremia. Vasopressin receptor antagonists, vaporizole and tolvaptan, corrected hyponatremia more effectively than other treatments, with several interventions insignificantly different from no treatment. Thus, promptly identifying hyponatremia in high-risk patients and management with agents like tolvaptan can decrease the morbidity associated with pituitary surgery. Tumor volume as a predictor of survival and local control in patients with brain metastases treated with gamma knife surgery. A clinical article by Andrew Boschnagel and co-authors. Current guidelines for the use of stereotactic radiosurgery for brain metastases take into consideration the the number of brain metastases and linear dimension, but not the combined tumor volume. Beaumont Hospital researchers examined tumor volume as a prognostic factor for patients with brain metastases treated with gamma knife surgery. In their study of 250 patients, they found that total tumor volume was a stronger predictor than the number of brain metastases treated for all of the following: overall survival, distant brain failure, and local control. This result was valid even when adjusting for other known prognostic factors. The results indicate that tumor volume may be a better predictor of disease burden than the number of brain metastases. Tumor volume should also be taken into consideration when treating patients with brain metastases with stereotactic radiosurgery, when designing future prospective studies, and when developing prognostic indices. Electrostatic discharges and their effect on the validity of registered values in intracranial pressure monitors. A laboratory investigation by Morten Andresen and co-workers. Clinicians rely on the monitoring equipment in the neurointensive care unit to provide them with timely and accurate data, data they use to make informed decisions about patient care. However, observations of non-physiological changes in intracranial pressure at the author's department prompted them to investigate if intracranial pressure monitors from major manufacturers were affected by electrostatic discharges. The authors evaluated 5 intracranial pressure monitors from 4 manufacturers. They found significant artificial deviations in intracranial pressure, which could prompt changes in patient care. One monitor displayed significant permanent changes in the reported intracranial pressure values, and in 2 other monitors, they observed temporary deflections. Based on these findings, the authors make a number of recommendations in the paper to increase patient safety. Thank you for listening. To read all the articles published by the Journal of Neurosurgery this week, or to listen to more podcasts, please visit us at thejns.org. For more information on how to submit your research to the Journal of Neurosurgery, please visit thejns.org and click on Info for Authors.